Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asada of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, hello everybody. This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County in the mysterious Ozarks in mid-America. And our guest this week is Grandfather Jaime Perez. Welcome back to the show, Grandfather Jaime.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you again.
Well, a lot's happened since last we spoke. We were able to get Grandfather Hunbot's men on, and we've had Grandfather Carlos Barrios, and oh my gosh, there's been some really special things happening, and I got chills all over right now, so I'll shut up and let you talk.
Well, I mean, I think it's always good to have them share. They have walked so far and so long and have shared so many things throughout the years. Ombudsman, of course, is, I consider, somewhat of a mentor for me because he certainly spent a tremendous amount of time in El Paso and did a lot for the people here as well, did a tremendous number of workshops, and really just tried to educate the young people about what's going on in the Mayan areas. And one of the things that I think is very admirable about Humboldt's man is that he's very cosmopolitan and international in his outlook, because he was instrumental in getting me involved directly with helping some of the Mexico City people in some issues regarding repatriation of bones and artifacts and so on from different European countries for some of the Aztec communities. I know that you might hear in the background that I have a train here, but I live close to a train track, so
we do too. So you'll hear them between here.
If it bothers you, no. You'll know that it's it'll happen periodically.
Well, at least
in any case. As I said, I really consider Humbert somewhat of a mentor. I apprenticed with him for a while, as, if I can call it that, to just try to learn as much as I could from him, and helped him also with some of the work that he has done in terms of just recovery of some of the information in so many of those archaeological zones in the Mayan area. But anyway, I did take a visit into Mexico in the old country toward the end of 2004, and I was kind of out of pocket of the United States for a while. And one of the things that, well, there's a couple of things. One of the things that struck me, sometimes we go, and I'm sure you experience this, we go through some hope and optimism, and then sometimes we go through kind of a little bit of a downturn. And I had that kind of a experience as I traveled into the old country in the latter part of 2004, because I saw a lot of changes. And some of them, I would say most of them, have created in me a certain sense of trepidation. First of all, the old country is now increasingly penetrated. They have built roads, highway quality roads, into many of the areas of the old country. In fact, they put a major four-lane freeway right across the medicine fields in the Huichol area, in the central state of San Luis Potosí in Mexico. And they have basically bridged a mountain pass to access the Huichol old country in the Sierra Madre in the state of Durango and in Zacatecas. And so you've got an increasing penetration of modern society, which brings with it, has brought with it, a couple of challenges. For example, one of the things that just is, kind of jumps out at you when you go into the old country is the amount of garbage. Before, it was difficult for people to get access to soda pop and alcohol and so on and so forth, and normally the trade was in glass bottles, and so you would always save those and go back and get more and so on when you were to trek into the villages or the cities. Well, now you have, since you have the freeways, you now have these coke trucks that are going into the old country, and they are distributing soda pop of different sorts and so on in plastic. And so everywhere you go now in the, as you go visit some of the elders in the old country and some of the families and so on, everywhere you see these plastic bottles, because obviously they do not have any kind of centralized collection system, recycling, waste, any of that. That's been an increasing problem, because now that there is penetration, people are going in there, people that are well-intentioned go to visit the old country and to get a sense of the ceremonies and rituals. They bring with them, now that they can drive there with their SUVs and so on, they bring with them all of the modern consumer goods that they get in the Walmarts and the big cities. And when they go there, they dispose of all of this waste and all of this trash. And even if they put it in bags, there's no infrastructure in the old country to handle all of that waste. And so just the amount of garbage that you can see is becoming increasingly a major problem that the people in the old country are going to have to get together and deal with somehow. It's difficult for many of the communities, families, and so on, to understand how quickly that garbage can impact everything in the old country. The second, that's just kind of like on the visual, on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that's affecting the old country is that because of the growth, economic development of those roads and so on, people are wanting to come and they're beginning to put pressure on some of the communities to sell their land. Now, you got to remember that in the old country, I mean, in the United States, this phenomena happened at the turn of the century. But in Mexico, you still have a tremendous number of communal lands, many of them called ejidos as a result of the Mexican Revolution, were farmlands that were distributed to farmers, essentially, and farming communities and villages in Mexico. Well, a lot of those communal lands are still organized under the native communities. And the Huichol Old Country, for example, which is the one I'm focusing on, they have communal lands. In other words, families cannot sell these or parcel them or subdivide them. However, right now there is a major move in the Mexican legislature to undo that. And you know what happened in the North American experience at the minute that they began to privatize land and make it a commodity, that a tremendous number of people, of course, were immediately dispossessed of the land, which is what I suspect is the goal in the new legislation. And so you have all these people in the old country who don't quite understand economics in the way that we do in the West, and so there's a tremendous danger that pretty much those communities that have survived this long will soon be dispossessed if the legislation changes and forces them to enter the market system with their land. So those, I think, are the two things that most, I guess, disheartened me when I visited at the latter part of last year, when I saw that impact. On the urban level, I think one of the disheartening things is that a lot of the young people, even those that are ecologically minded and are progressive and so on, don't quite get the culture. They don't quite understand what it's all about, and so it becomes kind of like a quaint historical footnote of some sort. And they visit the old country more from the romantic notion of you know, maybe visiting an Indian or something, and they don't quite understand the cold and brutal reality of life and different kinds of cultural views and perspectives. And so I think one of the things that I have tried to do in my work, of course, is to provide a bridge of understanding between what the modern culture is and what the traditional culture is. And, you know, I myself have had some kind of a wake-up call, in the sense that I have not successfully been able to do that with a lot of the young people, even those that think of themselves as being progressive. So I think that 2004 for me was a kind of a dawning realization that the work has not progressed as much as we would hope. I was looking recently at some of the work of the Instituto Indigenista in Mexico, which is basically the government equivalent of the Bureau of Indian Affairs here in the United States, and they have probably a collection of maybe 40 Indian organizations serving various groups in the country. And when you talk to them, most of their work is simply survival. Most of their work is simply to capture some of the language, or to record some of the music, or to but basically it's all oriented toward not losing what exists. Very few, I would say almost none, that I have been able to contact or that I have been to read about or track down are doing any kind of developmental work. Most of it is just kind of holding on by their fingernails to try to have whatever they feel is important culturally, in terms of their cosmology, their poetry, their music. Most of it is just trying to not lose it, rather than any kind of developmental activity, any kind of economic development or any kind a restoration, if you will, of the old ways. And so that, I think, you know, it goes along with these other experiences where, as I said, I felt kind of disheartened. The good news, if you know, to go on the other side, is that I did realize in my last travel that there were more people who were trying to understand traditional culture in its own terms. And the elders that I spoke to were really working very hard to translate, if you will, some, you know, different ideas. For example, in the old country, we have something called the giveaway. Now, it's really a misnomer, because in the tradition, the giveaway was not a giveaway. It wasn't charity. The giveaway was a formal part of the village economics that required that those who were entrusted with accumulating the value in the community had to redistribute that value so that everyone in the community could benefit from it. So it wasn't a giveaway in the charity sense, in the American economic sense of helping those that didn't have. That's coming from an idea that Western idea. The original Native idea was that after a season, after the completion of a particular calendar or a particular calendar year, that then whoever was entrusted with the well-being of the community was then obligated to distribute the wealth of that village to everyone who participated in that village. I believe some of the northern potlatches have that same concept.
In the Bible,
the idea.
In the Bible too, every 50th year is the Jubilee year, and all property that that was mortgaged went back to was original owner.
All
debts canceled.
That kind of is a consistent theme of always those that have more to distribute to make sure that they fulfill their obligations to the community. Giveaway, the English, the attaching the English words giveaway to it changed really the nature, the meaning of that. It wasn't a giveaway. It wasn't charity in that sense. The other thing also is that that kind of economics, that village economics where you accumulate certain value and then you make sure that everyone in the community gains from that value, is kind of really being challenged now because of both the encroachment of trying to make the land become a commodity, and this idea that somehow this value of hard work and selling your labor, that whole class way of thinking is something that's also penetrating very deeply, and I think also it is doing so at the cost of the traditional concepts. And let me just explain that for a moment. In the traditional community, you have apprenticeship and you have servitude and you have any number of relationships in which people help other people. And they enter into agreements, short-term and long-term agreements, so that you can help someone or be helped. And so those kinds of relationships have now kind of been distorted in the Western sense, because in the Western sense, any time that you do anything for anybody, it is a transfer of your labor. And presumably under the economic class system, labor is a commodity just like capital, just like equipment or whatever. It's just another factor of production. And so when you attach a class relationship or when you look at labor as a factor of production, then you interrupt the relationships that were established, long-term relationships that were established among different families for different purposes in order to help the community survive. And so, you know, television, radio, all of the media constantly reinforce these kinds of ideas or Western concepts. And basically the young people, the young Native people, are listening to this and watching this on television, and they are, I'm talking about, of course, the urban areas, and basically they don't have any other way of looking at things, and so they simply accept what they're seeing and what they're hearing, because they have no other mechanism that would balance out the propaganda. The elders normally stay in the rural areas. A few travel into the cities to do ceremonies, but mostly the ceremony is such an integral part of the rural experience that they who would be the only ones to kind of give another point of view to the propaganda, are not there to do that. So that's a loss, a cultural loss, for the communities when so many young people just kind of get taken in by the urban propaganda.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, you're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now, this AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason, but I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them, and that to me is the most important thing in a man's. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, and I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met, and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give a dollar to every son of a bitch in a room, and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and they're not going to whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course now they've got so damn many charities, and there's so much professionalism. You know, there's if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity. By the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So I mean, Christ, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch, and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to hope at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimistic. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
So the second part of that, I think, is that many North Americans, good-hearted people, compassionate people, loving people, try to help. Unfortunately, their help often hurts as much as anything else. And I'll give you some examples of things that I have experienced. I have taken, obviously, a number of people to the old country, both in the Mayan areas and in Huichol areas and Aztec areas and so on. And one of the things, give you some just really down-to-earth examples. In their mind, to help, they will take consumer goods. And so, for example, clothes. They will take sometimes used, but even when they take new clothes, they take these clothes to the old country and they give them to the families that they perceive have a need. Now, yes, the need is there. These are people that do not have a lot of things. Unfortunately, part of the cultural environment in the old country requires that certain people dress in particular ways. In other words, they don't dress in a Western dress, they dress in their traditional dress. Mm-hmm. And so in taking them even new clothes, jackets and sweaters and pants and socks and shoes and so on, they are also part of the assimilation process of the old ways into the modern urban ways. And so one of the things that I have recommended to people is don't take Western clothing, or take cloth, and let the people in the old country do what with the cloth what they need to do, and to either the forms and the patterns of their traditional dress, and let them dress themselves in a way that they're comfortable. But if you take Western apparel and you give it to them to help them so they won't be cold in the winter, then you're a part of the cultural assimilation. Even blankets, I tell people, be sensitive to the blankets. I have gone into the old country and I see all sorts of, you know, Bugs Bunny and the purple guy, whatever, you know, all of these cartoons and so on and so forth. And there's certainly nothing wrong with cross-cultural sharing, but when you give people in the old country Western dress and blankets with Western themes and with movie stars and so on and so forth, you are part of the process of destroying or of assimilating the consciousness of the people into something different. And so I think to being sensitive to those sorts of things, I mean, they're minor, they're trivial. From the Western point of view, certainly as urban people, you know, if somebody gives me a blanket with certain designs and so on and so forth, well, you know, I may or may not accept the messages of those designs. But a lot of the people in the old country are not equipped to discern or to make the cultural distinctions necessary, and they will just simply, you know, accept whatever it is that's being given to them. And so I think that those people that are well-intentioned and good-hearted, those are some things that they need to be careful with. Other things are, for example, giving. I remember one gentleman who gave one of the children there a lighter that doesn't, it's some sort of lighter that doesn't have a flame. You just click it on and you put your cigarette and you light it, but it doesn't have a flame, and it's, I guess, has some chemical in it. Who knows? Anyway, giving that as a gift to a young child. Yes, I mean, it was a nice gift. But from the point of view of the child, this is also orienting the consciousness toward high technology that does not exist in the old country. Which, again, this is not a judgment one way or another, negative or favorable toward anything, toward technology or otherwise, but simply to be sensitive to the fact that if these children live in an area where they still chop wood and they still live from an adobe earthen pit, fire pit, to heat their food and so on and so forth, and they're still using clay pots, we don't need to be giving them modern consumer goods that only will, first of all, they don't have anywhere to plug anything in, because they a lot of times don't have full access to electricity, and electricity also gets them into further debt because there's no income in the old country in the urban sense, in the economic sense that we're used to in the West. And so I think those examples to some people might sound trivial, but they're really profound, because if you're not allowing what little resource to come into the old country be a resource that they can use for themselves in a way that makes sense for them, then you're part of the problem. No matter how good-hearted and how well-intentioned you are, you become part of the problem. When you go into some of the ceremonies in the old country and you share resource, then that resource should be something that they can be useful to them given their particular circumstance. Now, many Native American tribes in the United States are doing very well with gambling, and, you know, this is good for them. And there's a couple of tribes that, of course, have made gambling illegal, and they have not taken advantage of that. But for those that have, that means that they have become really a tremendous source of revenue, of money. And one of the things that that really hasn't been talked about, but I certainly would like to put it on the table for discussion, is that there is an opportunity for true development in Native communities with the money that's coming in through the gambling. Because one of the things that they should not do is to go with the traditional ways of thinking, I'm talking Western ways of thinking, in which you have this idea that labor is something that people have to sell in order to survive, or that they have a duty to sell in order to survive, and instead start developing some of these stock option programs that that are getting more and more popular across the country. And by that I mean is to help people in the old country gain wealth, and not by forcing them to work in menial or trivial jobs, or by giving them charity, or by giving them grants every so often, you know, 50,000, 100,000, whatever grants, or education grants for community colleges and so on and so forth. All of those things are worthwhile in a Western urban sense. But rather than focus there, they should develop community trust funds so that they can help people gain ownership of the companies that they work in. For example, just take one dimension. In Mexico, you have a lot of the Huichol work in the tobacco plantations. Now, the biggest problem with the tobacco plantations is there's a tremendous amount of pesticides and a tremendous amount of people that get hurt every so often. And because there's no protection for the worker, the minute the native person gets hurt, they're sent home with their, you know, broken leg or their cut-off hand or whatever, and that's the end of it. They just become a disabled person living in poverty in the middle of nowhere in the old country. And that is the experience of so many people. So these native communities who are getting these tremendous millions and millions of dollars from gambling should create community trust funds that help those people, not by giving them grants or by giving them assistance or by giving them charity in the Western economic sense, but by giving them ownership. The community trust can leverage ownership of various corporations through their ownership of stock, and then distribute that stock of those kinds of industries, for example, that respond to the basic needs of the community, and give that ownership to the people that live in those communities. Let me give you an example of something that did not work. The Tiwa tribe in El Paso, Texas, had a gambling operation for a few years. And because they didn't know how to handle their money, they did a couple of things that were just terrible. Number one is that they were very inexperienced, and they got involved with the Texas politics and offended some of the powers that be, because, you know, here are these upstarts who were trying to push their weight around, and so they basically took the right of that tribe to have gambling. And so now the casino's closed and they're back to being poor again. But during the time that they were successful, during the time that they had the gambling operation going great guns, I think they were bringing in something like $80 million a year profit. And what they did is exactly the wrong thing to do. They took every member of the tribe and they gave them a house, you know, $200,000, $300,000 homes, to people, first of all, that were not used to, they barely lived in little apartments and things. They didn't know how to handle this well. So they got a house, and they got a car, and they got $20,000 to go to the community college and basically get brainwashed into the Western system. And they got free medical and so on and so forth. So you had this population of people in the reservation that all of a sudden were living in $300,000 homes, were driving Mercedes-Benz, were, you know, just going through money like there was no tomorrow. Oh. You had all sorts of goodies. I mean, you know, the drinking and the parties and so on and so forth. Okay. Fast forward a few years, Texas people decide, hey, we can't have all these Indians running around with all this money. We'll shut them down. And they did. 3 years ago, they shut down the casino. What happened? Well, now you've got these people who can't afford the $300,000 homes. They can't afford the car and the expense of the taxes and the gasoline and all the rest of it. They can't afford to continue eating and drinking like they were. They frittered away all the money that was supposed to be for education. They don't qualify for anything anymore because obviously they got so wealthy that they couldn't qualify for anything. And so now you have them all back kind of wondering, like, where do we go from here? So instead of squandering those millions of dollars into giving away in this kind of a charitable Western notion of charity, giving away all this money to them, what they should have done, and what I, in my humble opinion and with my limited experience, feel that all of the casinos should do, is to create community trusts whereby you could have bought some of the major industrial or manufacturing concerns in the region, their stock, and awarded that stock to all the members of the reservation, so that right now they'd still be getting dividends from their stock, and they could do with that money whatever they pleased. But what they did instead is they gave them cars and houses, all of these material consumer goods that they did not know how to handle or they did not necessarily want. Some people wanted to live in their traditional homes. They just wanted the money to be secure and so on. And that way they could decide how to live their lives and what they want to do with their lives. And so that, I think, is an example of a casino that, you know, bit the dust. But because they basically squandered millions and millions and millions of dollars, and now they're all suffering and they're all hurting because in Texas they're not they are not going to open casinos and they're not going to legalize casinos in Texas anytime.
They're not granting any gambling compacts.
Exactly, and so it's a sad example, but it's a perfectly reasonable possibility for any other. Reservation. So those that do have gambling concerns, in my opinion, should be looking at developing community trusts, not giving away all kinds of bought goods, but rather developing the community trust and then developing stock option programs where they buy a company stock and award the stock to the people so that they become owners. And then they live off their dividends, and then they use their dividends in a way that makes sense to them and to their life and to their family and to their children and to whoever, and not go in the traditional route of having the reservation chiefs basically own all the money and then just award whatever they think the people need. And that kind of paternalism is a real challenge because that's what's happening. I think in the old country, on the political end of it, and I'll just talk briefly on that for a moment, I was talking to some of the elders, and I said, okay, well, you know, you guys know what's going on, and you keep telling me what's going on, and I keep agreeing with you in terms of my analysis of what's going on, so why aren't you doing anything about it? And then they tell me, well, it's because the political end is another animal. In other words, the elder's job is to maintain the cultural values, is to share those with other people. That's their job. But when they deal with the pragmatics of policy, they have to deal with the governors and all the political infrastructure of the reservation. And that's where they come onto this wall, because most of the political infrastructures of the reservations are tied to the political infrastructure of the American government or the Mexican government or whatever government they're dealing with in turn. And so they have to play by those rules. I met the council, the political council of one of the communities. I won't mention them, so not to embarrass them in any way, but I met the leadership. The governor was an alcoholic. He was drunk most of the time. Anytime they wanted a quorum, you'd have to show up with all kinds of tequila so that the guy would at least be there. And it baffled me. I just could not understand, why is this guy the governor of such an important cultural group? And so I asked, you know me already, Blue Water, I'm not one to stay behind and just keep my mouth shut. So I asked, I asked the elders, I said, how in the world did you, because the elders had to give their consent, I said, how did you allow this governor, who's a consummate alcoholic and totally irresponsible, to be the one setting policy? And the answer was something having to do with the fact that he was a blood relation of I don't know who had a blood relation of I don't know who had a blood relation, and was the only one recognized by the government in this particular circumstance.
Oh.
And I said, to me, this is absurd. You do not put the policy of the community in the hands of people who do not know what they're doing. I want to take a step back
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
The reservation group that I just told you that lost the gambling license, the governor of that reservation actually supported the erection of a four-story statue of a conquistador in El Paso. And I went to the war chief and I said, how in the world is an Indian reservation going along with an idea that you set up a four-story tribute to a guy who is responsible for the genocide of your people? And his answer was, well, the governor doesn't know any history.
Yeah.
The governor doesn't have a clue. And I said, I can't believe this. How can a governor of a major Indian group not understand that a conquistador is a symbol of the genocide of the people?
Yeah.
And anyway, the bottom line is that's what happened. So that's an example of the cultural versus the political divide that exists in a lot of these communities. And as I said, 2004 for me was kind of like a downer in the sense of, you know, just getting to the practical realities of what was going on. And I only came back hopeful because some of the elders are working very hard to keep the thing together and to give the right kind of advice. But I did want to share some of those experiences with you and with your listeners. Because of the fact that that this is happening in an accelerated way. The poverty the lack of resource is getting worse. The conflicts within the communities are getting worse. And except for those pockets of people that are doing very well in the casinos, unfortunately, when I visited some of those, they're going in the exact wrong direction by basically assimilating themselves into a Western model rather than promoting or keeping the values of the ancients, which is certainly not completely enemy to the modern ways, but certainly there can, I'm sure some middle ground could be found.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of Indian people that I've talked with. Well, some of them, you know, they approach the casino thing with the leftover anger, even though it didn't happen to them personally. Well, some of it did, some of it didn't. They figure, this is our chance to get back at the white people, you know, rather than looking at it as a temporary vehicle to get them where they really need to be going, and that's creating their infrastructure. You know, so they're intense wrong to start out with sometimes. And of course, they're getting the backlash from this in California. You hear about what happened recently, the comments made by Governor Schwarzenegger.
Right, right.
And, yeah, somebody, this sounds like it'd be a really good startup business for somebody who's an economist to offer their services to Indian nations all the way around the country to explain to them, you know, how they can do this. Now, when you say gambling, is that north of the border? Is any of this going on south of the border?
No. Gambling, I'm talking about north of the border,
right?
Because south of the border, the Mexican government has that monopolized.
Right.
The government of Vicente Fox, they've given out, I believe, something like 20 gambling licenses in the country. And, of course, all you have to do is look at his relatives and to know who got them.
Yeah, right.
I'm talking about gambling north of the border. And, the one experience that I was recounting to you of a gambling concern that was actually shut down is the one here in El Paso, Texas.
That's a shame.
And that's the one that I have most familiarity with, just observing just some of the terrible things that happened.
Well, I know Texas is not real friendly toward Indians. I was interviewed Chief Hicks of the Texas Cherokee, and he had told me privately, and then he announced on the air that last year sometime Chief Charles Rogers, who has a clinic, Dr. Chief Charles Rogers has a clinic down in Matamoros, was kidnapped, held for ransom. Some men came into to his office and took him hostage and held him, and he was saying there's a tremendous problem with drugs and violence, murder along the border down there, and I guess he said the State Department had actually put out an advisory about it, and which upset President Fox, and there's a lot of things going on, but Chief Rogers will not cross the border anymore.
Which is
unfortunate.
Yeah, anyone that's perceived as being influential is at risk.
He's president of a Cherokee, the tribe that's recognized by, you know, the state of Coahuila,
right,
and can't even go down to Zaragoza to the yearly, right about now is the time for the yearly gathering, so it's a real shame. He's still operating his clinic by teleconference, but it's a really sad situation. And he had helped. There are some guys down on the border. Both sides, you know, Mexican and American, who had cancer,
right,
that he was helping and treating and doing a tremendous amount of good, but he's really limited now what he can do because he can't get his hands on his patients.
Right. Well, I certainly hope that through our conversation this evening that maybe some of those people with the right intention and some of those gambling reservations hear us. And and understand what we're telling them, to build community trust and make Indian people owners of significant concerns rather than giveaways. in the Western sense. You said it, I think, before, and of course, it, everyone knows it. You know, you teach a man to fish,
mm-hmm.
and so you don't give him a fish, and you don't give him a house, and you don't give him a car, and you know, what good does that do us? Because yeah, you give me a house, but I still have to pay the taxes on it, and I have to keep the repairs up, and if I don't have the infrastructure to do that, then you've just given me a huge burden.
Yeah.
And likewise with a car and so on and so forth. So I would hope that some of those people with good intentions, good hearts, will begin to look at bringing those of us in who are working on community trust rather than the same old traditional way of doing things.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that this couldn't have been foreseen, because I know there's a lot of tribes that's just ruined. And that in Canada, you know, some of the tribes up there, for the first time, you know, the women are actually turning in some of the chiefs for corruption. You know, money,
right.
Power, and power corrupts. And it's hard when you take people that aren't used to having any kind of money and then immerse them in it. And
right.
You're setting them up for failure, and then you wonder why there's so much suicide. Well,
absolutely. I think that's why the conversation should turn from, you know, just accumulating money to how do we make Indians owners. And, you know, there's so much money in casinos in the United States as a group that even if all the casinos in the United States put 5% of their profits into a national community trust to support Indian ownership, it would have a tremendous leveraging effect economically. In other words, Indians could become, as a group, as an interest group, as a special interest group, could become the motor of ownership for those that have very little in this country and could really turn all the reservations around. But right now, the model that they're following is the Western model. And in the Western model, it's all about accumulation. It's all about the rich getting richer. And if you follow that model, then you're going to continue to see the destruction of what's left of Indian country.
Well, have you read any of Vine Deloria's books?
I'm sorry?
Have you read any of Vine Deloria's books?
No, I haven't.
You ought to, because he talks about how this can be done, and that a lot of things can be done. You can become your own insurance companies, and you can do so much. And there's so many opportunities that are being missed. I'll find out which of his books where he talks about this economic plan and how people can go forward with it. But he's a professor. He's a Sioux Indian, as I recall, and I hope that's right. I don't want to get an arrow in my shirt. But, yeah, I'll have to ask my friend, because he was telling me that Vine Deloria, who's a very respected educator, had a good plan and talked about this in one of his books. And
I'm sure that he he's on the same wavelength, because just from what you described, and that's exactly how people should be thinking, is how can Indian country, with the enormous resources that it has, some sections of it have these enormous resources, how can you make the rest of Indian country owners and resourceful? And it can be done. And the models are there to do it. It's just simply that they haven't thought about it, or they're not thinking in that way because they're too busy making more millions of dollars on their casinos. And unfortunately, from a cultural standpoint, it's been a really destructive force in terms of the life experience of so many of the people that identify as Indian or Native and so on. So anyway, the situation of the North Native American Indians is so much better from a financial standpoint. But culturally, I think that if we're not careful, pretty much we're looking at the final chapter of Indian country in the United States, if it continues going in the direction it is. And in Mexico, it's you multiply whatever the problems are here thousandfold, and that's what you have in Mexico.
Yeah.
Because over there, they don't have any resource. They're still living in a condition, in a rural condition, that's the equivalent of what's going on here in the early part of the 1900s. and late 1800s, because it's that bad. It's that deprived in the old country.
Well, I know Indian people, they make very good students, and I've noticed that we pick up the good and the bad habits. Well, it seems like in the United States, Indian politics, I know Cherokee politics is kind of like national politics maybe 100 years ago. It's just a real free-for-all, very nasty, and which is not real good. And, you know, Chief Hicks says, you know, we're our own worst enemies. We ought to be able to take the best of the best. And, who was it that said, you know, take the good and with a breath of kindness blow the rest away?
Right.
Well, we sure appreciate you. That's an excellent idea. And, you know, this program's coming of age, and I know your voice is going to be heard. And your background is in economics, isn't it?
Yes, in public administration and political science and economics.
See, the Western world, you know, you're doing what you need to do. So it's like we need more Indian lawyers so they can use the master's tools, you know, to make additions or amendments to the House, you know, because I'm part of the House. Some people approach it with, you know, well, let's use the master's tools to tear his house down, but, you know, why go in with a negative?
No, you have to go in with this idea that we are bridges. And those of us that can coexist or exist in two different cultures, we're bridge people. You know, I understand the culture in its own terms. I understand Western culture on its own terms. And I understand the diversity of viewpoints and ideas in both. And so that puts me in a wonderful place to provide analysis and to provide recommendations and ideas and advice and so on and so forth. The fact that I have remained committed to the traditional values has, you know, now as I continue to see in the waning years of my life that maybe I could have made other choices when I was younger. But on the other hand, I'm saying I would not be who I am if I had made those choices when I was younger. So I have to just accept that, you know, I may never be in a position to provide a key leadership role or to do what I want to do or what I think should be done in my own life. But at minimum, through writing and through conversations like the one I'm having with you and the fact that other people are listening, perhaps, you know, there's enough of a germ of an idea that will reach those people who are in a position to do something, who are in a position to influence policy in a good way, so that we can start moving in a direction of really coming together in four directions. And I think that cultural precept of the four directions of accepting everyone in their basic humanity, that we are really all one family, and that we have to respect each other's cultural identity as we would respect anything else that's different about someone, that's really where we need to be. And I believe that in the native point of view, which is that we're all one family. I believe it in the Western point of view, kind of the Unitarian Universalist point of view, which is also, I think, shared by the Buddhists, and it's certainly shared by, you know, the basic Christian point of view, that we're all one under God and so on. I think all of that's a consistent theme in all of the Universalist religions. And so I don't think that there's any conflict between being of any particular race, ethnicity, and so on. Rather, it's an enriching experience. And that's how we should approach it. People who, you know, talk to me and tell me that one is better than the other are people that are limited because they do not see that they are more than just whatever cultural identity they have at any given point in time. You know, I've had people come up to me and saying, well, you know, I can't accept your culture because I have this other culture. And I just look at them and I'm baffled because that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. The only thing that makes sense is I'm a human being that has a particular structure and different particular point of view, and it evolves throughout your lifetime.
They can, are they, Well, if they just look at the fact that saying, well, you know, I'm a Christian, you're an Indian. Well, you know, there's other Christians that have slightly other ideas, and they put up with them, so why can't they put up with an Indian?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
You know,
it's just that they limit themselves to thinking that because they have an experience up to this point, that is all of their experience. And, of course, that's not the case. The experience that you have up to this point is whatever experience it is, but it's part of an evolutionary process that's going to end when you're 6 feet under. And so when you look at it that way, and when you understand it that way, then you become so much more tolerant and so much more forgiving and so much more accepting, because you understand then that you are just an unfinished product, and everyone else around you is an unfinished product, and together you can evolve in a way that makes sense for everyone as a whole. And that little point of view of just saying everyone as a whole, as one family, is where I think most people get lost, because they start falling into this idea that they're separate, that they're part of a group, or they're part of a one family, or one race, or one religion, or one whatever. And the minute you fall into that idea that somehow you're different from other people, then you create that reality around you, and all of a sudden you are different from other people, because you separate yourself out, instead of understanding that you are not separate from other people, but you're part of whatever it is. I remember one time I was going to this city and visiting this particular location, and somebody, and I was telling them, well, I feel a little bit awkward because everyone there is, is kind of like not in the same mindset that I am. And a friend of mine told me something very interesting, which is what kind of snapped me out of that thinking. He said, don't look at the location as a place where certain people congregate. Rather, go to the location and understand that location reflects the people that are there. And, well, you know, that really shifted the way I saw things, because even if I'm the only one that thinks in a particular way or feels a particular thing or believes in something, once I become part of the mix of that group, then I have a validation, I have a presence, I have a voice in that particular group, and the group by definition changes. But if I don't go because I think of myself as different or they think of me as different, my voice is not part of the mix, then therefore I don't exist in that mix, and I have diminished myself in terms of my own value, but I've also diminished the group, because I have not given them the opportunity to hear my voice, whether they reject it or not, but at least they have the right, or they should have the right to hear my voice.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow, but tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quinones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quinones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better. I feel a lot better and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
And so I really appreciate that friend. I was very young when he told me this, and I really appreciate my friend, because since then, whenever I'm invited anywhere, I go, because I understand that I am doing them a respect by sharing my voice, and I'm respecting myself by validating that my point of view is just as valid as anyone else's.
Well, you know, next, you might point out to your Christian friends, and I know a lot of most Christians simply do not read their instructions. They a lot of the Bible talks about, you know, how they were given stewardship over the land, and they get the attitude that, you know, the land's beneath their feet and they're masters of it. But, you know, there's the flip side of the coin. You know, recently a person called attention to a scripture in the book of Revelations, the Apocalypse, that talked about the time would come when it was time to kill those who were killing the earth. So, you know, there's a wake-up call, folks. You know, maybe Native people do have something to teach people of the book, because the Muhammad said that when the seas begin to rise, you know that Judgment Day is coming. Brigham Young said that that the sea would begin to heave itself beyond its bounds. I mean, there's so many indications and implications of this tsunami that we need to think about, and it may not be over. We need to take a good hard look at, we're going to be getting more wake-up calls, and they're going to be coming closer together.
Well, one of the things that I tell people, and certainly the people in our group and so on, the people that I work with, is that, you know, we can look forward to the end of times, and then when the end of time comes, and then we're still there, and we can look forward to the other end of time. And so, you know, we have to remember that in the way that the natives see this, time is circular.
Mm-hmm.
And we always come back to the same place until our end of time, which is when we're no longer here. The question is, what kind of quality are we going to have in our lives during the time that we're conscious? And that is a very profound question, because you can focus on the destruction, and you can focus on the pain and so on, or you can focus on how you're living your life, which is, of course, my preferred way of living, is I travel and I observe and I see and then I communicate and I recommend and I travel again and I do healing and I see and I get feedback and it worked, it didn't work, I can do this better, that better, and so on and so forth. And that's the way that it enriches a lifetime. But if you are focused on all of the gloom and doom,
mm-hmm.
I know people, for example, who are busy building caves and putting rifles in them and trying to get ready for Armageddon. And I'm telling them, in the meantime, you might also want to plant some corn and
mm-hmm.
get along with your children and meet some of the neighbors. And, you know, if you feel you have to prepare for Armageddon, that's fine. I mean, we have to understand that and validate the fact that that's just as real. On the other hand, in the meantime, live life
mm-hmm.
and live it in a good way and share that in a good way with other people. And
that's what the Hopi elders gave their 10-point message to Chakosh, the Chumash elder. They you know how are your relationships? You know, where do you live? You know, where's your water? Do you know your garden? Things to consider.
And you know, many people they ask me, well, why do you even? I live in the city. And they asked me, well, why do you still, after this idea of planting in the spring, and, you know, I've had a number of gardens that have come and gone in my own home, and this year I plan to do it again. And they asked me, well, why? You know, why don't you just buy whatever you need to buy at the store and so on and so forth? You don't live in the farm anymore. Well, one of the things that's important to understand is that when you put your hands on the earth and you actually dig, and you are, you know, putting the seeds and, you know, watering them and paying attention to what's going on and so on and so forth, all of that is a connectedness between your physical body and the earth, and it enhances both. You're giving value to the earth, and you're giving life in the form of nutrition and so on and so forth, but at the same time, you're getting also a tremendous amount of energy to your physical body. And your body is putting out energy, not only toward the earth, but to everything around it. Many people say that I have a very good hand because everything I plant grows. And they ask me, well, what's the secret? And I go, well, there's really no secret to it. It's just simply that when I do it, I'm focused. I focus intently on what I'm doing. And I pay attention to what I'm doing and to the seeds and to the plants. And as they grow and if they need to be cut or trimmed or whatever they may need or more water or less water or whatever I may have to do. But I focus intently on doing it. And in that relationship, there's almost like a dance that occurs or that happens in the relationship with between myself and the plants, because it's an understanding. It's like dealing with another human being when they may need something or they want to share something, and being sensitive to that and understanding the language that they use, whatever language that might be, whether it's a physical language or a sound language or a musical language or whatever it is, that the form that they are expressing themselves. That's the secret to having things grow and be productive and fruitful, and that's why I have so much, I think, success in working with plants and so on. No secret, just simply to pay attention and be as loving in the process as you are with other human beings.
Very good. Do you see any progress with? I know Pope, the Holy Father would like to see, you know, things be better for Indians. But what about the local priesthood, the local laity? Do you see any change? And I know it's difficult to see change, maybe in a period of a year, maybe more over 10 or 50 years. But what about last year? Do you see any progress in that area?
I really don't, frankly. I'm very pragmatic in that respect. I certainly feel, and I'm sure you saw in my book, that the apology of the Pope to the native people of Mexico was a very significant event. I think most of the Western world press missed that, but certainly the Mexicans didn't. And I think that it was very, very healthy that the Pope told the Maya and the Aztecs that their ritual and their dance was welcome inside the church, and that I think was very, very good. But at the local priest level, I think the consciousness is basically the Western consciousness, which is it's just a matter of time before we're able to assimilate everyone in the old country, and so let's just it's kind of like a patronizing them and saying, okay, well, we'll let you use the church on a Saturday to do a ritual, but gradually try to wipe it out.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately has been the history of Mexico, and I think that there's nothing that would indicate to me that that's going to change in the near future. The experiences that I've had in some of the smaller churches in the old country, or rather that serve some of the rural communities, they have that mindset, which is the assimilation. Part of that is this idea of wiping out the languages. One of the things that you and I talked about the last time was that I hope that one of the things that some of these wealthier native communities can do is just build dictionaries of the native languages. But the Spanish, here in the United States, we have the English-only kind of movement. In Mexico, you have the Spanish only, where they're trying to wipe out the native languages. And so that is part of the problem, because to the extent that you wipe out the native languages, you wipe out all of those words that capture the ritual, dance, and so on of the native ceremony. And once you lose that, you pretty much have lost the nonverbal underpinning of the knowledge, of the communication, of the wisdom of the ancients. And in many of the communities, you will see the ceremonies, and there's like an overlay of that kind of Christian overlay to satisfy the local priests. And that kind of underground process continues to go, but that has a double-edged sword, because some of the younger elements that come into the ceremony they see the Christian overlay and assume that the Christian overlay is part and parcel of the traditional ceremony. And in fact, some of the stories then become distorted. Whereas, for example, in the Huicho, you have, of course, that the deer is the paramount, in nature, is symbolic of the animal that's good and inoffensive and represents no danger to you. And that's fine. But it is also true that in the Huicho cosmology, any animal has a certain virtue by virtue of their existence, their instinct, and so on, and can be a teacher and friend and so on. Well, the Christian overlay, of course, you have Jesus being redeemed, being the Redeemer. And so after a while of hiding this relationship of nature, of man and nature, under this concept of Redeemer, pretty soon the deer takes on all of the qualities of the Redeemer. And so when you have any kind of offering, like when you hunt the deer in the traditional coming-of-age ceremony, and you cook it and so on and so forth, and you take the blood and you do a blood offering to the fire and those sorts of things, pretty much then it takes on the Christian cosmology, and they start talking about it in terms of the deer being almost the equivalent of the Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, that's the double-edged sword, because pretty soon then the deer ceases to be authentic in the Huicho storytelling and becomes essentially a surrogate of Jesus in the Christian cosmology. And so, that can't happen anymore. I mean, the native communities have to be able to express their cosmology in its own terms and not have to be under the threat or the coercion of the local Catholic authorities. Unfortunately, in Mexico, the Catholic Church is very, very strong, continues to get stronger. And, this is not to take away any of the good deeds of some of the bishops and archbishops who have tried to minimize the injustices against Native communities. But on the other hand, we have to recognize that this defense of Natives is not simply a defense of Natives. It's also a defense of Natives so that we can convert them.
Right.
And so, that's the other half of the equation. And to the extent that they do that, they are stripping the Native communities of their authentic cosmology.
Well, tradition.
Now, in the overall sense or in the overall truth of the world, is this a bad thing? Well, if you believe, you're Christian, you believe in Jesus and so on, you think, well, it's not so bad because at least we're bringing them to God. But if you're not a Christian, this is genocide. It is a cultural destruction of a people and of their own internal sense of identity, of their own internal structure. And it's akin to putting the Indian children in a Christian school and stripping them of language and so on, as happened in the United States, of course, in the late 1800s and so on, and early 1900s. So I think that I'm beyond anger and outrage. I mean, that's not even where I'm coming from. It's just simply to observe it and to understand that it's still going on and that we have a responsibility, in my mind, to articulate it and to say, hey, that's what's going on. It's not right. It's not ethical. It's not what needs to happen. There's nothing wrong with teaching an Indian child the Christian philosophy and the Christian viewpoint, the Christian morality, as well as his own traditional cosmology. What's wrong with that? We don't have to make them enemies. I mean, I'm sure that the fundamental precepts of the Christian viewpoint are consistent with the fundamental precepts of the Native viewpoint because they all call to our basic humanity and our basic compassion. So why not teach both?
Yep.
But unfortunately, in these kinds of, we have histories we were saddled with, and in Mexico, the idea is that you have to convert everybody. There's this proselytizing imperative among Christian churches. And so as long as they try to convert everybody, you're going to have this this withering away, this cultural destruction.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether you heard, I had a chance to listen to our interview with Dr. Gostol 2 weeks ago, but he was recounting his trip a few years ago down south of the border with the Umbats men. And he was saying they went into a certain grotto and they were listening to some traditional teachers teaching, and it was being translated into Spanish. And he said every once in a while the person would lapse out of the story and then start reciting the names of Catholic saints. And Gostwolf asked, well, what's that all about, Unbas? And he says, well, he says, there's pieces of the story that are missing, and they know that are missing, and when there's part of that missing, they just substitute those names, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so there's an example of what happens when things are forgotten and traditions are passed along orally. And if we
but, you know, it's not even, if it's, I wish it was that innocent, Luana, but it isn't. The Friar de Landa, certainly in the Mayan areas, he burned all the books.
Yeah.
And then what he did is he hired some local scribes to redo some of the books and to change the stories so that they would fit more within the Christian cosmology. There are many, well, not many, there are just a handful of surviving codices, all of them post Hispanic invasion. So I don't have any confidence in anything that has been presented as native traditional works, because they were all commissioned by the Catholic Church to basically convert the Indians. And so, you know, you can't have any confidence. And that still goes on today. They will hear an oral history, and then they will change, the names and events and the players to suit the Catholic cosmology. One time I was listening to another elder that I apprenticed with for a few years, and Don Andres was doing his ceremony, and so I asked him a question. He was teaching me about, and I'm trying to remember what specifically, but I asked him a question, and he says, oh, this goes far, far back. And he says, this comes even from Moses. I said, Moses? How'd Moses get over here to Huicholand? And I laughed, you know, and he's saying, and he got serious again. He says, no, he says, he continued the story, but he threw in Moses and he threw in the crucifix and he threw all of those sorts of things in. But when I pressed him, he said, well, those are things that we were taught that we had to say when we presented this story. And of course, in his generation, the priest had to check all the stories that were being taught in ceremony. And and they either approved them or they didn't. If they didn't approve them, they had to change them or modify them so that they could get approved.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated.
Good.
And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever.
I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie Osmond.
Put it
Osmond.
Under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
So I had to do a lot of research to get the real stories.
Wow.
And excise all of the superimposition. And I remember that even the candles, in the traditional ceremonies, they use candles made of animal fat. And so all of a sudden we went to this pilgrimage in the old country in San Luis, and he says, well, we need to get a candle. And I said, you know, grandfather, we have candles. And he says, no. He says, when we come to this place, we have to go to the church. So here we go 20 miles out of our way to the church to get a wax candle that was, according to the traditional ceremony of that area, absolutely part of the pilgrimage and required. And we got the wax candle that had all kinds of Christian figures on it. Then we go back to where the traditional ceremony was held, and then we could complete the ritual. And so that astonished me, that baffled me, and I said, so why do we have to go to the Catholic Church to get this particular type of candle? And the elder says, well, his elder, told him that unless he did that, they would not be allowed to have the ceremony. So those are the sorts of things that are constantly part of this conscious policy of the Catholic Church to basically eliminate what's left of Indian culture, pure and simple. And so, you know, it's not, I wish it were that innocent that, oh, well, you know, they got mixed up and whatever, because that's just not how it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, those things are still happening in age, and unfortunately, we have to just, as I said, articulate it, because I'm beyond anger and outrage. That's just the way it is.
We had Nicholas Chungo on, I guess about a month ago, and he had been, when he was born, they knew that he would be the bridge between the Salasaca Aymara people in Ecuador and the outside world, so they taught him to leave his heart at home, but to go to high school and learn to do these things. And he was their first national president when they had their first government-to-government relationship with Ecuador. But he was threatened that if he didn't leave the country, the special forces would come in and wipe out his entire people. So he comes to New York, can't even get a job washing dishes, eventually goes to Wisconsin and starts to get some education. They ends up at the UN and involved in the whole process at the UN. And you know, when I spoke to him, he says, you know, after all the years at the UN, he says he comes to the conclusion, you know, there's, you know, they're planning everything for indigenous people, and not to put words in his mouth, but it was almost like the entire permanent forum for indigenous people was just so much window dressing. It's kind of something that I had sensed, I had guessed.
Right.
But
well, the thing is, as I said, that's why I value programs such as yours so much, because it gives us an opportunity to talk about these things and to put them out there. And you know, it's a way of getting the message to the people, and people can they do with it what they will, but at least they've heard it. And I think one of the things that's a disservice to people is when people don't speak frankly about what's happening. And, you know, just so that other people know. There's a saying in Spanish that says, he who doesn't speak, God doesn't listen to. And you have to speak. Otherwise, things just continue, and there's nothing to mitigate the tremendous amount of damage. I was saddened that one of the groups that have been holding space in Mexico City for a long time, they've had a lot of challenges because a lot of their members have lost work, and and they're just struggling to survive. Their work has pretty much stopped as a result of the tremendous economic pressures on them. And I keep thinking, you know, here you got millions and millions of Native people still in the old country in Mexico, and you've got these few hundreds of thousands of people with this huge amount of resource in the United States. And at some point, I hope that the consciousness of the Indian people is such that all Natives realize we're in it together and we have to help each other. But not in the conventional giveaway sense, but rather in a developmental sharing of ownership sense. And I hope that that those people and those tribes hear what we're saying and come together and become a motor for positive change for Indian country instead of just another source of infection, if you will, of the traditional exploitation of people.
Well, Indians north of the border are going to have to gain more respect for Indians south of the border, too. That's a whole other story. Say, how about your new book? How's it coming?
Well, I'm actually right in the middle of it, and one of the things that I, and the reason I've talked about it tonight is because I'm really focusing on the tribal economics, and I want to really come up with a prescription, not just talk about, you know, this should have or would have or could have, but rather this is what needs to happen in a very specific way. And my research over the last few weeks in the chapter that I'm in right now is about that, just to make sure that the prescription is something not only that's usable but pragmatic, and that, you know, anyone can understand. And I'm really trying to make it accessible to anyone with good intention and a good heart.
That's good.
So I hope to my goal is to have a draft by May. I still think I'm going to be able to make that, anyway, we'll just have to leave it there and see what happens. But I hope to have a draft by May and probably a publication by the end of the summer.
Well, we've covered the waterfront. Is anything gone unsaid?
Well, as usual, we do cover just quite a survey anytime we get together. And again, I appreciate you letting me participate with you, and hopefully, like I said, our words will reach enough ears that that we can make a difference.
What about gatherings in Colorado?
Well, as a matter of fact, I will have a 4-day workshop here in El Paso, Texas, in March 22nd to the 25th.
Excellent.
We'll be doing some very pragmatic things, everything from nutrition, physical nutrition, exercise, to planting, to harvesting, to healing and traditional ceremony. I will be doing that in the 4 days, 22nd to the 25th, and for the equinox. And then the summer solstice will be in the Ritter Foundation in La Vida, Colorado, and that'll be on the 17th through the 21st. And we will be having a series of workshops there as well. And again, everything from physical nutrition, organic gardening, vitamins, all that sort of thing, all the way to the traditional healing ceremonies and pilgrimages. So I welcome any of your listeners, and to please spread the word to join us in El Paso in the next month, and or at the Ritter Foundation in La Vida, Colorado, in the third week of June for the summer solstice.
Excellent. And they can find information at Casa Jaguar?
You can use casajaguar.com, or you can email me at jaimeopérez@yahoo.com, and I'm happy to respond to any inquiries.
Always enlightening, stimulating, and just wonderful to talk to you.
Well, Blue Water, it's always a privilege and an honor, and I thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Thank you, and we'll be talking to you. Do you have a mailing list?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm on it. I'd love to pass along. I'll make sure to get on your list. That's what I forgot to do. so I can pass along to people on the Native Prophecy Council, okay?
Very good.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandem has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities, such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandem reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandem reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
You want to get an edge on turning back the clock with just a few pills? Who doesn't? Well, it's no longer science fiction, but science possibility, a potential breakthrough. As I found out firsthand, there may be a way to erase years, at least inside my body. Granted, it's down the road, but some scientists are wondering if a new pill I took might offer a very long life.
It may not look like the Fountain of Youth, but inside this nondescript building, I'm about to become part of an exciting experiment, a kind of guinea pig.
Dr. McCord, okay.
I'm here at the University of Colorado in Denver to meet Dr. Joe McCord, a world-renowned scientist.
This is pretty exciting stuff you're finding, huh?
It is. We're very excited about it.
His latest research could very well unravel the mystery of aging itself. And his decades of experiments may have the potential of adding years to people's lives and possibly prevent chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. It all centers around this small yellow pill, and for me, it begins with a blood test.
It wouldn't be the first time I've given blood for this company.
They want to check my levels of something called T-bars, which is a rough indicator of a person's actual age. T-bars can identify a condition known as oxidative stress, a kind of measure of the wear and tear on our bodies. Oxidative stress, like the rusting of an engine, is not a good thing.
Bad for the body.
Leading to disease.
Leading to disease and leading to malfunction, and importantly, leading to what we call aging. It is a slow progression of increasing oxidative stress. That's the main characteristic biochemically of the aging process.
The problem of aging begins with the very food we eat to give us energy. As our cells burn that food, they also release toxic chemicals. Those chemicals, you may know them as free radicals, react with all the components of our cells, literally bombarding them millions of times per second, damaging all our cells. The result? Oxidative stress. And we all have it. The body fights back with a system of defenses. It makes two antioxidant enzymes, catalase and SOD, whose job is to gobble up the free radicals before they can harm our cells.
So, doctor, how often do I take these?
And so, here I go. With that swallow, I've just become part of a potentially landmark scientific experiment.
Doesn't taste bad.
It's called Protandim, and tests on both mice and humans have already shown that it revs up the manufacture of those good enzymes in our bodies. More enzymes, fewer free radicals to harm us. Whether that will lead to longer life is still unknown. Experiments to see if mice live longer are about to get underway, but it's a tantalizing theory.
Right now, all we know is that this preparation decreases oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is not a disease, just like aging is not in itself a disease, but it's something that accompanies and is attached to many disease processes. So you can see the age-related...
Normally, oxidative stress, measured by those T-bars, increases with age. But in Dr. McCord's tests, taking just one pill of Protandim a day reversed that trend for everyone at every age, even for an 80-year-old.
They all are reduced to the level of oxidative stress that one would expect, frankly, in a newborn or a very young child.
Back to the oxidative stress levels of a child? It sounds too good to be true. Will Protandim work on me?
The scientific evidence is there. The pieces seem to make sense. The question is, does this translate into something that humans can take advantage of?
And so, ancient Eastern healing and modern Western medicine may soon be working together. High oxidative stress is associated with more than aging. It's been linked to hundreds of illnesses.
It's at the very center of many diseases. Liver disease, diabetes, emphysema, asthma. I've studied all of these. Strokes, heart attacks.
Even mental disease.
Yes.
Depression?
Alzheimer's disease, depression.
Dr. James Crapo with the National Jewish Medical Center in Denver is also researching Protandim for the company.
Are you saying that this could be a cure-all?
You're looking at something will have a small impact, but an important impact.
We make no claims about curing any disease or preventing any disease. We hope that when enough studies are done, perhaps such claims might be able to be made in the future.
Clinical studies to assess Protandim in both diabetes and heart disease should start in 3 to 4 months. But what about my progress? After nearly 2 weeks now, it's time to get my results. Dr. McCord calculates the numbers. The result? My level of oxidative stress has declined dramatically.
45%. That's excellent.
Just look at where I fall on the graph. Before and after.
Which, if extrapolated back, is the level you would see in a newborn baby.
Have we turned back the clock? Well, maybe not on the outside, but deep inside, within my cells, yes, indeed.
Would you suggest I keep taking this supplement?
I would. I can't guarantee it's going to extend your life. I can't guarantee it's going to eliminate any diseases or cure any diseases.
But we do know that oxidative stress is part of those disease processes. I don't want to wait until I'm 80 years old and find out that I should have taken it.
For more, go to our website at abcnews.com.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Major universities and government agencies initiated and continue self-funded studies following the ABC Primetime Investigative Report you just viewed that originally aired in 2005. These studies continue to reveal more scientific evidence about Protandim's unique benefits. They are published in major scientific and medical journals. The next video will bring you up to date.
Developed after 40 years of research and exclusively for LifeVantage, Protandem is a true scientific breakthrough in anti-aging. Protandem has been reported on ABC, NBC, and PBS, featured in the Wall Street Journal, and described in CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta's book, Chasing Life, The Quest for Immortality. Protandem's creator, Dr. Joe McCord, is a world-renowned scientist and a pioneer in free radical biology. Dr. McCord is the discoverer of the key anti-aging enzyme, superoxide dismutase. His role in the discovery is so significant, the enzyme is measured in McCord units. For Dr. McCord's discovery of superoxide dismutase and his contributions in free radical biology, he was awarded the Elliott Cresson Medal. This medal is awarded to distinguished inventors and scientists, putting Dr. McCord in the same company as Pierre and Marie Curie, Alexander Graham Bell, Orville Wright, and Henry Ford. Dr. Joe McCord has devoted his life's work to the study of free radicals, their role in aging, and the many problems associated with aging. Consumers spend billions every year on antioxidants in the form of food and supplements, hoping to reduce these free radicals. But antioxidants from these sources can only eliminate one free radical for every one antioxidant molecule you consume. Protandem is scientifically proven to slow cellular damage caused by free radicals. Taking one Protandem one time per day for 30 days turns on these anti-aging enzymes in your body. Your own enzymes eliminate free radicals at a rate of 1 million to 1.
I think any other supplements that are designed to be antioxidant supplements probably are no longer needed because Protandem solves that problem in a much more effective way.
Protandem is a breakthrough poised to revolutionize the anti-aging industry. It is an entirely new and scientifically validated way to fight aging, reducing your oxidative stress levels to that of a 20-year-old after just 30 days.
We found, as many other scientists had documented, that there is a progressive increase in T-bars in your blood the older you get. When these same people took Protandem for 30 days, the age-dependent increase in lipid peroxidation was completely eliminated. After Protandem, we could no longer distinguish the 80-year-old from the 20-year-old.
Protandem is protected by 3 U.S. patents. Universities around the world continue to initiate and fund their own studies of Protandem and to evaluate how this anti-aging breakthrough can prevent and improve many of the hundreds of problems associated with aging.
Many academic scientists at a number of universities have begun studying Protandem because it represents a new tool. It represents a way of reducing oxidative stress that wasn't available before. There simply was not a good way of doing what Protandem does. Protandem interacts with the DNA in your cells and causes the cells to make more of a set of genes called survival genes. The ingredients in Protandem were actually selected because they are largely metabolized by the liver, which does not interfere with most prescription drugs, which are generally metabolized by the kidneys. So the general answer to that is yes, it is safe. The immediate benefits of Protandem are within several days, the biochemical markers of oxidative stress begin to decrease. And while these are immediate improvements, you may not sense that these things are happening, just as you can't sense what your cholesterol level is, if it's high or low. But nonetheless, these benefits start happening within days of taking Protandem. The advantages to taking Protandem in the long term are that it protects your body from the relentless progression of free radical damage as we age. The anti-aging aspect of Protandem is one that accumulates over time, so the longer you take it, the more protection you will sustain. Missing a dose of Protandem is not a big problem.
It takes about 2 weeks for the effects to go away. So if you miss it for 2 weeks, you're pretty much back to where you started from.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Good afternoon. These are on, I presume. I'd like to talk to you today, and do I have control of these slides, or is I do? Okay. Let's get through these really quick, because this is just because you have to get CMEs, and I have to tell you that I am on the Speakers Bureau for GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, and also a nutritional consultant for an HIV nutritional company named Biosource Therapeutics, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about today. What I'd like to talk to you about is something that I find thoroughly fascinating. It is glutathione. It is one of the four endogenous antioxidants, and it is one that I must admit, despite 80,000 published articles in the English literature, through medical school, internship, residency, fellowship, and a fairly long time in academic medicine, I knew nothing about. It is a very interesting molecule because it exists in an accelerated or increased energy state. The energy state is, or increased energy state, is caused by the fact that it's got a free sulfhydryl group and therefore can easily donate the hydrogen to a electron and therefore quench a free radical. Now, let me tell you, because I think it's important, and it is a little bit of a divergence, but I learned about glutathione because of something that you probably all have seen in your practice, and that is a low uric acid. Now, when I was in medical school and when I was a professor of oncology, the only thing I knew about uric acid is when you had a kid that you were going to treat for leukemia, you put him on allopurinol to keep the uric acid down. I knew nothing about uric acid being low, except it kept appearing, and it appeared in about 20% of my patients, and that just didn't make sense. So I finally went into PubMed, and after stumbling around for a long time, I found out that uric acid is the last antioxidant your body uses when it's run out of everything else. When it's run out of gas, okay, it uses uric acid. Interesting. So if that's the last, the question then, what was the first? And that is where I got into glutathione. I've been coming to some of these meetings for a while, and glutathione is very important for a number of things, not all of which I'm going to go into today. But in point of fact, it has a great deal to do with not only well-being, okay, but aging well, or if you will, retarding the aging process. So I think it's very applicable. I'd like to, at the risk of repeating things that you already know, go over some of the things that glutathione is important about. Alone in the antioxidant world, okay, every other antioxidant, when it becomes oxidized, becomes itself a free radical. Glutathione doesn't. It actually recycles other antioxidants. In fact, the body considers it so important that up to 6% of the entire ATP expenditure or energy expenditure of the body may be used to synthesize and optimize glutathione levels. That's pretty impressive, 6% of the entire energy output of the body. It is also the only non-enzyme antioxidant that doesn't become a free radical and in fact has a very interesting corollary when it becomes oxidized, because what happens is it complexes to another spent glutathione molecule and the compound then becomes GSSG, and GSSG has been shown in animal studies at least to promote and induce delta wave sleep. We all know the importance of that in terms of the aging process, so this, even in its used up form, functions as a very useful product. It not only functions as an antioxidant itself, but alone again in the world of antioxidants, it is an absolutely essential component of antioxidant enzymes, namely glutathione peroxidase, and most importantly, the glutathione transferases. And I bring that up because Glutathione transferase abnormalities have now been associated with virtually every cancer known to man, and probably with a lot more than that. And therefore, by promoting the production of glutathione transferases through improving glutathione, we may be doing even more than I'm able to talk about.